Welcome back. It's a Wednesday, the 7th day of November, 2018. I'm your host, Mark Hall, and yes, it's the day after. And while the smoke may not have yet cleared, and indeed the smoke screen is, of course, still well underway, at least some things are a bit clearer. One of them that might not be, though, is whether the battle between those beginning to wake up and those who want to continue to rig things saw any real resolution. When the irresistible force met the immovable swamp, what happened? Well, to some extent, just about exactly what you might have expected. A stalemate that pretty much represented the path of least resistance, at least for now. And yeah, I guess you could call it good news and bad news. And there was plenty of ugly, too. So let's start off with a look at midterm election 2018 that way. First, the bad news. The United States, the formerly free republics, will have the most openly communist, anti-constitutional House in its history. And notice I didn't use the term House of Representatives, because arguably, people who put their hand on the Bible and lie, and that's the majority of them, don't really represent anything, other than being feckless and faithless. And when it comes to the good news, well, at least some of the good news, yeah, it could have been worse, and was no doubt intended to be. Many of the worst were actually rejected, and that goes especially for the Senate and some of the major gubernatorial slots, where the highest-profile socialist, communists, and outright gun banners were rejected. And given the vast amounts of money, media, and manipulation involved, you could even say decisively. So it wasn't a blue wave or a red wave. Those colors were chosen deliberately to be deceptive anyway. It wasn't even quite a Bolshevik wave, but it was a Bolshevik splash. And here's the other interesting thing. Whether the election was honest or not won't really matter, much less be exposed, let alone reported on. Because with the likes of Adam Schiffless and Mad Maxine in the House, now taking positions of even greater power, the first order of business, even ahead of impeaching the president for crimes to be made up later, is covering their tracks. Come to think of it, do they really even need to bother with claiming things like high crimes and misdemeanor? Because that's a constitutional term. Nowadays, it ought to just be sufficient to say they don't like him. They hate him. Almost as much as they hate the nation, people, and rule of law he was trying to save. And that's enough. And there is one more bit of good news concerning the stalemate aspects, and that is that the immediate false flag riots and war threats are probably, for a couple of days anyway, on the back burner. Meaning the next real threat remains the economic meltdown, about which the election changed nothing whatsoever. Some of the truly ugly we'll get to in a while, along with some of the better of the good as well. But let's start this wrap-up more or less chronologically, beginning yesterday afternoon, with a story I saw repeated time after time from literally all over the nation. The Daily Mail summarized it in this headline, "Broken voting machines, mosh pit polling places, faulty software, by design," your cynical host inserts, "and ballots locked inside a foreclosed strip mall. The huge American voter turnout is hit by problems across the country. States," it said in the subheadings, "are struggling to handle an overwhelming voter turnout Tuesday. In New York, people left polling stations after waiting more than 2 hours. Counties in South Carolina, Texas, and Georgia have major technical issues, while in Arizona, early voters showed up to find their polling station had been foreclosed overnight Tuesday and literally locked down. It seems," says the story, "that a number of counties simply weren't prepared for the surge. Or who knows, maybe the under-preparation was encouraged, for reasons that might be obvious unless you work for the fake news." Speaking of which, this story makes that point again. The infamously leftist propaganda organization masquerading as a news site, MSNBC, accidentally called the Florida governor race for the communists there a day early. Oh, so sorry, but they certainly got their message out anyway. Trouble is, they were preaching to the perhaps arguably satanic choir. Here's a summary of the story. It's actually up several places, but the Washington Examiner is representative. MSNBC, it says, mistakenly sick, aired a graphic of the Florida governor race Monday night that showed 99% of the vote in, and the Democrat candidate, well, you know, the outright communist, Andrew Gillum, winning via a slight lead. Whereupon Chris Hayes, MSNBC host, told their smattering of viewers, "Just want to say, earlier in the hour, we showed a graphic of the Florida gubernatorial race. May have caught your eye. Well, it was intended to, because our system had inadvertently populated some test numbers." Hey, haven't we heard this story before? Obviously, he continued, we don't yet have any vote totals here the night before the election. That was a misfire. Ah, come on, who are they kidding? It was wishful thinking, a subtle bit of pre-election manipulation, and intended to be a dry run for what they hoped to be able to, report later. Thankfully, it also turned out to be a lie. On then next to the numbers, which are of course still in the intended state of flux. As I've already mentioned, the House, which was already socialist, even with an alleged Republican majority, is now solidly outright, as of the new term anyway, progressive/communist. Officially, the Democrats needed to take 23 seats to swing control and put the true nutcases in charge of the major House committees. As of Wednesday morning, most counts show them up between 27 to 34 seats, meaning at least a slim party line majority, and a left tilt that's even greater than that. Meanwhile, the razor-thin Republican majority in the Senate, and it was even thinner if you realize that some of the rhinos, call them flakes, couldn't be counted on anyway, was shored up substantially with a gain of probably at least 3 Republican seats, and even more if you count those that are thankfully now gone, like Arizona's Jeff Flake, and those like perhaps Mitch McConnell, and especially even Lindsey Graham, who weren't themselves up for re-election, but who may have actually of late started to try growing, let's put it politely and say a backbone. Gubernatorial races, too, were a mixed bag. Republican Mike DeWine won Ohio. Perhaps most importantly, Ron DeSantis did defeat the far-leftist Andrew Gillum in Florida, solidifying their control over 2 key swing states, but the far-left took over the governor's mansions in Wisconsin, Michigan, and Kansas. Meanwhile, in Georgia, it certainly looked like one of the worst, pretty much openly gun-banning and outright communist Stacey Abrams, had been defeated by Republican Brian Kemp, the Georgia Secretary of State, but she's refused to concede, and there may end up being a runoff there. If we have time today, we'll come back to some more specifics for various races. But I do want to at least touch now on some general observations, as the smoke at least begins to clear. First off, obviously no blue wave, as even CNN's primary socialist Van Jones finally conceded. Others have observed that the youth vote didn't seem to turn out, although the illegals evidently did, and that made the far left very happy. On the other hand, Republicans who actually embraced the new president seem to have been rewarded and won big. Several upset wins for the pro-Trumpers against various Democrats. I've already mentioned DeSantis in Florida and many others in important races that the president's been campaigning for over the last few weeks. And the exception to the rule, Kris Kobach in Kansas. But the untold story, as a number of pundits are pointing out, was the strength of incumbency. And the fact that about 40 Republicans, many of them never Trumpers, retired, didn't want to face re-election anyway, and Democrats ended up taking 34 of those seats. There's an exception to the rule there, too, at least kind of, sorta. Rhino Paul Ryan is thankfully gone. He wasn't going to be Speaker anyway, but new Representative Brian Steele did at least keep his seat. And you could almost call that a net pickup for the Republicans. Anyway, bottom line on that score seems to be that what some are now calling Trumpism, whatever that means, is the future of the Republican Party, and more of the never-Trumpers, rhinos, and even what some are calling conservatives are gone. Stick a fork in them already. I do need to point out, however, that that doesn't necessarily include a whole bunch of neocons that are still in there. So yeah, any way you slice it, the swamp is still full of crocodiles. Which brings me to this really interesting observation, courtesy of Breitbart. I'm sure there are others that picked up on it, too. And there are implications here that go beyond just the mere numbers. Republicans, they say, were disappointed to lose the House of Representatives to Democrats on Tuesday, but they did gain, of course, several seats in the Senate. Here's the key. Overall, the GOP outperformed the historical average, though, for a new president's party. They point to a recent historical analysis of midterm election trends that said, over the past 28 midterm elections since 1906, the president's party has lost about 30 House seats on average and 4 Senate seats. So any way you slice it, Donald Trump's Republican Party either did a bit better than average or at worst at average for the House, which they lost, but a gain of 3 or maybe 4 seats in the Senate literally defies history. That, of course, is in part at least a geographical quirk, they note, because the GOP only had 8 of its own seats at stake in these midterm elections, while Democrats had 25. And that includes some left-wing so-called independents. And I guess it shouldn't be any surprise to anyone that a lot of the Senate losses are being blamed on the Kavanaugh circus and the fact that so many of them were revealed to be nothing short of absolute, well, nutcases. As for your host, folks, I'll suggest that if you look at a map of the United States, yes, even with the bogus red and blue colors, especially the deeper you drill, say all the way down to the county level, there's an obvious trend that isn't getting too much commentary. Because the fake news, of course, is all about reporting the first black woman this, or the first openly gay that, or the first illegal transgendered Somali immigrant, convicted pedophile, and so forth. You can pretty much name your groupthink. In other words, so far as the waste stream is concerned, what color and what sex people think they are and who they sleep with matters a lot more than whether they believe in the rule of law, or even less, what their oath before God is worth. So ignore all of that noise, folks, your host will suggest. The big battle this year was hardly red versus blue, or far left versus what now passes for conservatism, which is medium left, or even fill-in-the-blankophobia versus reality. It really was rural versus urban. Or you could put it differently and say those that are self-sufficient versus the collectivists. Emoting versus thinking. Freedom versus force, or those that understand rights as opposed to privileges. Much like we saw in the early 1860s, there are some geographical boundary lines being drawn. But this one isn't the Mason-Dixon, north versus south. It's a lot more spread out, more city versus country. And I guess you could even say those who know where food comes from and those who think it's found on the shelves at Safeway. Which means I can't help but think that there's more volatility ahead. And I guess that finally brings me to at least part of the, well, we've had the good and the bad, so now the ugly. Starting with Minnesota, which seems to want to be the Sharia test case for the formerly free constitutional republics. One of the worst of the very worst, the unindicted criminal and Soros pawn, former number two at the DNC, Keith Ellison, who had been called just about the mostest leftist in the entire House, won a narrow victory overnight to become, and I kid you not, the Attorney General, sick, of Minas Sharia-Soda, which may say more about what's happening to the rule of law than anything we've seen yet. But I have a suspicion we're just beginning to see what's coming. And there was more ugly, too, from the left coast, where Washington State passed just about the most restrictive anti-gun so-called law in the People's Republics. It was the only statewide issue of its kind on the ballot, called I-1637. 60% of the gullible folks there decided, nah, we don't need to defend ourselves from what we welcome right into our own living rooms. And I guess the best way to summarize this abomination is 30 pages of tyranny, folks. Everything from gun storage laws, Achtung, we will take them anyway, und this gives us one more excuse, to age limits, to more Big Brother barriers against self-defense. Pretty well, you name it, and it too is greasing the skids for what's obviously next. And this one too pretty well demonstrates the case I just outlined about rural versus urban collectivist. Guess where the gun banners live? And guess where the people who are working hard to make sure they need them the most won't have them. And I had been planning on saving this next story for later, more as an encouraging way to wrap things up, but we'll use it now because it fits here, from Mike Meharry at the 10th Amendment Center, Dateline Douglas County, Oregon. Voters in 8 Oregon counties have passed ballot measures that set the stage to create what supporters call gun rights sanctuary counties. Second Amendment preservation ordinances on the ballot in Oregon passed in 8 of 10 counties today, creating a mechanism to guarantee that no county funds, at least, will be used to enforce gun laws which violate the Second Amendment. And in most of the counties where these things passed, they actually passed by landslide margins, over 70% in some cases. And yeah, that too helps to illustrate, graphically, the rural collectivist divide. And it also helps to demonstrate, in more than one way, what people can and should be doing on the very local level. And I also do like what some folks are saying about these things, when they talk about them at all. Fox News senior judicial analyst Judge Andrew Napolitano, in a recent televised discussion on the issue, noted that a single state taking this step would make federal gun laws, quote, nearly impossible to enforce. Of course, the same thing would be true if we actually had trial by jury. Or, oh, imagine this, people that could actually read what the Constitution and Bill of Rights says in genuine print. Said Michael Bolden of the 10th Amendment Center, quote, partnerships don't work too well when half the team quits. By withdrawing all resources and participation in federal gun control, states and even local governments could help bring these unconstitutional acts to their much-needed end. And yes, folks, lest we doubt it, remember that the Trump administration actually ramped up enforcement of unconstitutional federal gun laws in 2017. So I guess it's time to summarize some of the other specifics. In the House, as I've mentioned, Democrats secured the minimum of 218 seats needed to regain control of that soon-to-be very much communist body. Democrats won Republican-held seats in Colorado, Florida, Kansas, Minnesota, surprise, surprise, New York, Pennsylvania, and Virginia. While in the Senate, you had major losses by the Democrats, including the recently outed by Project Veritas in Missouri, far-left Senator Claire McCaskill, who pretended to be what doesn't really exist anymore, a conservative Democrat, and Senator Joe Donnelly of Indiana. In Texas, thankfully, their own version of Pocahontas, although in this case it's an Italian claiming to be Hispanic, Bobby, a.k.a. Beto O'Rourke, maybe it should be pronounced Beto O'Rourke, lost his race to Senator Ted Cruz, who retains the seat, may even be a bit less of a sellout going forward. He's certainly less of a never-Trumper. While the wannabe communist Santa Ana, demonstrating that his lack of constitutional integrity is exceeded only by his class, actually dropped the F-bomb during his concession speech. So he clearly has a big future in the new left. And as we've already mentioned, and even the Financial Times pointed out, there may be a silver lining for Trump because many of those who were ousted were moderates and anti-Trumpers who'd resisted the Trump agenda anyway. So now that they're flushed out, Trump may have solidified his dominance of the party. He did seem pretty happy. He tweeted afterwards that it was, quote, a tremendous success tonight, thanks to you all. And also tweeted that, quote, those that worked with me in this incredible midterm election, embracing certain policies and principles, did very well. Those that did not, say goodbye. Yesterday was such a very big win, and under all the pressure of a nasty and hostile media, unquote. The anti-constitutional Nancy Pelosi actually had the gall to claim that somehow or other, what they're going to do is restore the constitutional checks and balances. Yeah, by undermining an election and getting rid of an elected president, if they get their way. And that, of course, brings me back, like it or not, to more of the really ugly as a result of yesterday. Not only is the evil Nancy Pelosi, or perhaps someone even worse, and yeah, they certainly exist in that swamp, now likely to be the next Speaker of the House, but there are some real gems on tap for high-profile committees. Notable for their perfidy, if nothing else, is inveterate leaker and the ultimate counterexample to the incredibly now misnamed House Intelligence Sick Committee, Adam Schiff for brains, who's already made it clear how he intends to put a wooden stake in what's left of the rule of law and stonewall anything even remotely resembling a real investigation into trivialities like treason and high-level corruption, in favor of a never-ending series of witch hunts that might even make scumbag Robert Mueller blush, but I doubt it. And you got it. The only way to make this blithering idiot, and I'm trying to be as kind as I can here, folks, because the alternative is to suggest that he knows what he's doing, which is even more criminal. Anyway, yeah, the only way to make this blithering idiot look even remotely credible is to find somebody even worse and put her in charge of, I don't know, something associated with a financial committee. Ah, enter Mad Maxine Waters. She can help put a wooden stake in the financial system, cover up a few more crimes, and call for still more violence, and get even more coverage from the lapdog press than before. So, yeah, if there truly is some ugly in this situation, maybe you could call it the blue flush. That's got to be it. And you know what, folks? I will pause and take a deep breath here, because truthfully, I wasn't all that angry about these results, such as they were, until I started remembering what it would mean we were going to be forced to witness in these high-profile committees. And I'll admit it, that's not the kind of news I have any desire to talk about. Come to think of it, of course, neither is this next story, but I intend to do it anyway. Yep, take a look back at history. Senator Joe McCarthy was right, and now the House is openly communist. So, what does that mean? I guess the right answer is, ask the banksters. So I'm looking at a piece from Zero Hedge by Goldman Sachs, entitled, What Gridlock Means for the U.S. Economy. Not that we can trust them, but we ought to know what they're looking forward to. Here then is Alec Phillips, Goldman's political economist, on what a divided U.S. Congress, or gridlock, means for the U.S. economy and U.S. policy for the next several years, at least as much as we can handle. Number one is no major changes on taxes. Given that there is a divided Congress, the chances of any major tax legislation getting passed are slim to none. He doesn't mention it in here at all, but given the House will be so focused on impeachment that they really won't care too much about anything else, that's a given. Spending, they say, is likely to be extended, i.e. continue to run amok around current levels. Gee, tell me something we don't know. And thus, an infrastructure deal also seems unlikely. Healthcare, they say, was and will remain a major issue. And your cynical host suggests, watch those rhinos still in the Senate cave on that one, too. Especially as the economy melts down. Trade policy says the Goldman guy shouldn't be too directly affected, and socialist control of the House shouldn't have too much direct impact on the stifling regulatory agenda, since most of the destructive stuff they'll try to come out with should be blocked by the Senate. But here's their stink bomb. Fiscal deadlines will become somewhat riskier under a divided Congress because of, you know, destructive debt limit debates that have happened before and will no doubt happen again. One thing's for sure, folks, if the so-called Republicans couldn't get it done right when they did control both houses, it's only going to get worse from here. The debt bomb is ticking, and nothing that happened yesterday is going to stop that or even slow it down. Which brings me finally to a bit of a digression, but along these same lines. This comes from Sven Heinrich via NorthmanTrader.com and Zero Hedge. And it's arguably a better look at what's coming economically. We're in one of the longest economic expansion cycles in history, he begins, and nobody's happy. It's mind-blowing. You'd think 2018, at least if you believe the numbers, would have people dancing in the streets with alleged 3.7% unemployment, record stock market prices, well, at least up until lately. But, he suggests, what happens if you have record stock buybacks, record dividends, and record earnings, but 89% of all assets still yield a negative return in terms of U.S. dollars? No, really, he says, that did just happen, and the short answer is, nobody knows, because it's never happened before. No wonder the Fed crying has begun. And then there are headlines like this. America's 1% hasn't controlled this much wealth since before the Great Depression. 1 in 3 Americans have less than $5,000 saved for retirement, and 65% of all Americans save little or nothing, while half could end up struggling, to put it mildly, in retirement. But don't worry, the Bolshevik Revolution will take care of that, even if it means those death panels they keep lying about. Well, says Heinrich, wealth inequality is vast, and nobody's happy, and if things are so great, why is political discontent so high? Yeah, I admit, some will want to blame Trump, and perhaps one could argue he amplified some of the symptoms for his own purposes, but the disease was already there, and it seeded the stage for his arrival. So here's where he's headed. The current political climate is as hateful and volatile as I've ever seen, he wrote. And if you think folks are PO'd now at 3.7% alleged unemployment, just wait until 6 or 8% comes back. Along, your host adds, with maladies like inflation levels that'll soon be undeniable. The real consequences of all this, he concludes, will only truly come to light during the next downturn. And obviously, if you saw what happened yesterday, there's no leadership on the horizon, certainly not when it comes to economics, from the socialists. And as for the Fed, yeah, they're standing there with the pin, ready to prick the bubble. So if this is how things are at the end of an expansion cycle, understand what's coming. Division, resentment, and yeah, anger. Here finally a story that I saved until almost the end. James O'Keefe and Project Veritas dropped another undercover video on Tuesday showing election officials in Texas admitting, quote, tons of non-citizens voting there, prompting the Texas governor, Greg Abbott, who won his re-election bid, to say, this will be investigated. No doubt, folks, there was more than a little bit of fraud on a number of levels and in a number of different ways. Perhaps enough to thwart a red wave, not enough to replace it with a blue one, but at least consistent with the preconditioning and history, good enough not to look overly suspicious. And given what's going to happen in the House, and the continuing socialist media silencing of any dissenting voices, you already know a congressional investigation is more than a waste of time. Now, the dreaded Ruskies certainly didn't do this. American Soviets may have, but in any case, let's just call it close enough for deep state government work. So it's more important now than ever to know who you serve, and may Yahuwah bless you and yours.